Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. A series of retirements ahead of the 2026 election means Delaware's General Assembly will look different next year.
Maybe a more interesting part of it is that there are also bigger picture factors that influence retirements. For example, a party that's out of power or looks like it's going to go out of power may face higher levels of retirement.
We delve into why these changes are happening and their potential impact. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also examine how vehicle-to-grid technology can help solve growing energy capacity issues. Arts Playlist previews the local performance of the first opera written in a U.S. tribal language. And Enlighten Me focuses on a Delawareans documentary on dealing with stress by staying connected. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Several fixtures in Delaware state politics have announced they won't seek re-election this year, some after decades in their seat. Their decisions to step aside leave room for new faces, and the possibility a seat or two could flip to the other party. Incumbents opting to leave has become a bit of a trend in the first state. In both 2022 and 2024, multiple incumbents did not pursue their seats in the General Assembly again. This week, Delaware Public Media political reporter Benta Boutier dives into this trend and the implications of this round of retirements with University of Delaware professor Paul Brewer, who specializes in political communication and public opinion.
We have several lawmakers retiring from the General Assembly, both in the Senate and the House. I was hoping to chat with you to see what your take on this is.
The sometimes idiosyncratic reasons why legislators retire. The Democrats in the legislature are one seat away from having a majority where they can pass constitutional amendments without any Republican help. That's a stake for the fall elections, which these retirements could influence when candidates step down. There's no incumbency advantage. The odds of the seat flipping could go up. Legislators have lots of different reasons for retiring. Sometimes they think that they're going to be facing a tough re-election battle. Maybe their district has changed in a way that they think is going to make it harder to win re-election. Maybe a more interesting part of it from our point of view is that there are also bigger picture factors that influence retirements. So, for example, a party that looks like it's going to go out of power may face higher levels of retirement. I think we're seeing this at the national level in Congress, where there's a really high level of retirements, especially on the Republican side, because the forecast suggests that the Republicans are going to have a very hard time keeping control of the House. If you're a legislator and you're likely or nearly certain to be in the minority party, that can be an incentive to retire. Minority party members don't really get to do a lot, especially if a situation like Delaware, where one party has a pretty strong grip on power. Legislators, when incumbents are in that situation, some of them decide this isn't worth it to me anymore. I'll pursue other opportunities or spend more time with my family. You know, sometimes they might even mean that.
There are a couple things I wanted to return to there. Facing a tough re-election, you're looking at people who have been in for 10 years or more. So it kind of seems like once you're, when we're looking at the list of names here, Heffernan, Gray, Lawson, Collins, Charles Postles, Dave Sekola. These are people who their constituents know really well.
In general, incumbents win Delaware legislative races. The big advantage is one is fundraising. People like winners. It's easier for them to raise money. The other is that they have name recognition. So you get to Sekola and like, oh yeah, of course, he's my state senator. In a low information environment, which is pretty characteristic of Delaware elections, it's tough to get your message out there without money and without doing a lot of retail politics, door-to-door politics, which, because Delaware's a small state, that's still actually a feasible thing to do. The higher up you go, U.S. Senate races in competitive states, the incumbency advantage isn't that big. Now, there have been incumbents that have lost in Delaware, if you look at the list, but there aren't that many.
We get to 2020 and Democrat state senators flipped two seats in the Senate, but also four of seven incumbent Democrat lawmakers lost their seats to challengers. But that was kind of an unusual year.
Yeah, it's a change election or a wave election. special individual circumstances, which I think explains some of the incumbent losses in Delaware legislative races recently, or there are big picture national circumstances, waves that sort of catch incumbents in their tide, that's when you can see incumbents lose sometimes. I'm not saying that Delaware is immune to those political tides. I think there's good reason to think that if the elections were being held today, there'd be some very challenging national political circumstances for Republican candidates in particular.
And then I wanted to return to national dynamics a little bit. The number of Congress representatives that announced a retirement in maybe 56, I'm saying that was like, that's the most in 30 years, right? I'm wondering what reasons that might influence anything with our state politicians.
There could be multiple ways that the bigger picture spills over. One is these national kind of partisan tides. If potential candidates think that there's going to be a wave election, say a wave election that helps Democrats and hurts Republicans, which is a possibility. Republicans who foresee a close race may decide this isn't the year. There are also two other things besides the national political trend in terms of partisan lean. One is polarization. At the national level, legislative politics has become very polarized, increasingly polarized over the last couple of decades. What I mean by that, members of the two parties are farther apart from each other. So they might be more coherent. There aren't as many conservative Democrats or liberal Republicans, but when the parties are farther apart, it can create a contentious legislative environment where compromise is difficult. You send me a study that suggests, and I find it very plausible, that in terms of state-level polarization in legislatures, Delaware is on the low end. That wouldn't surprise me at all. Delaware has a history of kind of centrist, quote-unquote, Delaware way politics. Maybe the state is moving away from that somewhat. One thing that I do wonder about that I think has gotten some discussion in public discourse, whether American politics in general is becoming increasingly violent. There's a potential assassination attempt on the president. How many days ago was that? Not very long ago. Increasingly, legislators may see a career in politics as risky for their personal safety.
The state is kind of unique politically because there's this through line of interest in the corporate franchise. There's bipartisan support for House Bill 370 to codify DFAC, and that seems like a pretty good example of times lawmakers are unusually cohesive or in step from both sides of the aisle.
People who have been in Delaware politics a long time, they might talk about Mike Castle, Republican. So he was more of a moderate, business-friendly Republican. The DuPont family had some politicians in that mold too. They were also the kind of politicians who seemed very open to working with similarly corporate-friendly Democrats. Point to people here like Tom Carper, the past governor John Carney. When you have leaders of both parties being non-extreme on a lot of, kind of social issues and then being close to the middle of the road on a corporate-friendly political ethos, then that makes cooperation pretty easy. Now, there aren't as many Mike Castle Republicans on a prominent stage statewide. The state Republican Party has gone more down the road of the Tea Party as the Democrats have solidified their control over statewide elected offices and the legislature. There's more of an obvious tension between the more centrist, corporate-friendly elements of the party and then the more progressive, anti-corporate elements of the party, which I think shows up a lot in Democratic Party politics and primaries.
That's been getting talked about within the Republican Party for a second now. It feels like that's been developing at a national level in my memory since like Sarah Palin became like a national name for people, but it seems to have maybe hit Delaware a little later. I'm wondering what you see as the chances of seeing these kinds of candidates crop up within the state Republican Party now.
Sarah Palin, she was 2008. I feel like kind of the first Sarah Palin-like figure in Delaware politics was probably Christine O'Donnell, who I mentioned Mike Castle earlier. He was running to be the Republican Senate nominee in 2010 and was expected to win both the nomination and be a very strong contender in the general election, but he was upset by a Tea Party candidate, Christine O'Donnell, who then went on to lose pretty handily to Dr. Chris Coons. And since then, I think you have seen some more candidates in the Palin mold more recently since the rise of Donald Trump. We might call them Make America Great style. Generally, candidates like that have done poorly in general elections in Delaware. It'd be very tough to run. But it's interesting to watch who the Republicans nominate in these statewide races because I think it's been a challenge for them to find strong, credible candidates with high chances of winning in these statewide races over the past few election cycles. You had sent me an article suggesting that they were recruiting a candidate for attorney general who had actually run for two statewide offices before and lost, so she turned them down.
You said like kind of a lack of good candidates available is because that was at their nominating party. They brought her up. They hadn't found anyone. She found out after the fact that she was getting nominated, which seems like an interesting way to find out you could be running for political office.
It doesn't seem typical. Little history. I think that's how Zachary Taylor found out that he was the Whig Party nominee. But obviously, I don't know the detailed circumstances behind that, but it seems like an indicator a party having a challenge finding strong candidates. I think that's important. You look at positions like attorney general, that's a very credible platform for running for governor, Senate candidates. If the Republican Party could place a candidate in one of these lower statewide offices, actually attorney general is like the two or three spot, like treasurer or insurance commissioner, anything would give them a starting point for running a candidate for a higher office.
I think he's the chair of the Republican Party in the state was saying he thought there was a place for Republicans to gain that foothold. It feels like your evaluation of that seems unlikely.
He's the head of the state Republican Party, so you know he's got to say that. Fall elections are 6 months out. A lot could happen. Looks like it could be tough for the Republican Party in general in 2026. Broadly speaking, national political environments spill over. Looking at public opinion polling, Donald Trump's polling numbers are pretty low right now. He's like the high 30s, which is a rough place for a president to be.
Gorman is running for Sokola's open seat, and she's in the House. And so where you see the Democratic Party going, kind of more of the same amongst them?
You can point to individual legislators who might be on the progressive side of the Democratic Party's political spectrum, to the left of not just people like Carney, but maybe to the left of the current governor, Matt Meyer, too. There's been some tensions within the Democratic caucus over who's going to be their speaker. That boiled over a cycle ago. But really high-profile positions, I don't think there's been an AOC yet of the Delaware Democratic Party. You know, a really high-profile person who's taken on the Delaware political establishment. Instead, it's been more competition between more traditional Delaware politicians. Two of the things I've been watching for years is, can the Republicans come back and recover at the statewide level? The other one is there going to be, on the other side, a more progressive Delaware politician who really stands outside the Delaware way, wins a statewide election, becomes a U.S. rep or a governor or even a lieutenant governor.
Thanks to University of Delaware Professor Paul Brewer and our Bente Boutier for joining us on The Green this week. And stay with us. The Green continues with a look at technology developed years ago at UD that may now be ready to help electric grid capacity. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Concerns about electric grid capacity remain in the headlines as surging demand, fueled in part by AI and data centers, stress the system and contribute to rising electricity costs. But what if your car could be part of the solution? It may be if you have an electric car. Vehicle-to-grid technology, developed by University of Delaware Professor Willett Kempton, has been around for about 30 years, but the timing may finally be right for it to make its mark. This week, contributor John Hurdle takes a closer look at where V2G tech stands and why it may be ready to take off in his latest piece at DelawarePublic.org. And he joined me this week to discuss what he learned. So, John, can you start off with a thumbnail sketch of exactly what vehicle-to-grid technology is? What does it do? How does it work?
Well, vehicle-to-grid technology allows EVs, electric vehicles, to send stored electricity from their batteries to the power grid during times of peak demand. And the idea is that the technology would be fitted to the EVs during a pilot program. It was kind of retroactively fitted to some EVs that belong to Delmarva Power. But the advocates hope that future EVs are going to be manufactured with this technology already fitted.
So how would this help the rising issue of grid capacity?
Well, by feeding unused power back to the grid, V2G can help to meet peak demand at a time of rising concern that the grid is not going to be sufficient to meet rising demand, particularly from data centers, which, as we know, are going to have an enormous additional demand on the grid. There's one crucial piece of data that's relevant here, and that is that according to the advocates' estimates, the EVs are actually parked, that is, they're unused, an average of 96% of the time. And so what they say is that that represents a huge asset for storage, that there's a source of electricity storage that could be used.
So this technology, John, has been around for a while. Why haven't we heard more about it? What's been holding it back from having this kind of impact we're talking about?
Well, this was proposed by a University of Delaware professor called Willett Kempton back in 1997, almost 30 years ago. And it wasn't widely adopted at the time for a variety of reasons. One is that federal and state regulation needed to change, and that takes time. Some of that has already taken place, and the state is working on that as well. The industry standards needed to change, and because EVs were not yet equipped with this so-called bi-directional technology, which allows not only the EVs to offload power onto the grid, but also to take power from the grid at the times that they need it. So that's the technology that will be fitted in order to enable this, and which the advocates say is actually scalable.
So what's changing now to give V2G a boost?
One key piece of changing federal policy about 5 years ago, in fact, is that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission instructed regional transmission operators, organizations like PJM, which operates the grid that Delaware is a part of, to enable the application of this V2G technology. So that's one of the things that's changed that sort of helps the prospects of this. There's also increased demand for storage to help grid resources. And very crucially, there's cash available to EV owners for providing what are called grid services. And one of the conclusions from the pilot program that's just concluded at the University of Delaware and Delmarva Power was that up to $3,300 a year is available to EV owners for putting their power back into the grid. That's a calculation based on electricity prices between 2001 and 2005. And that number, in fact, for owners of fleet vehicles and heavier vehicles, that number can go up to about $9,000 a year. So those numbers will help to defray the additional cost of buying an EV. I mean, that, by the way, is currently about $10,000 over the equivalent model of a conventional car, a conventional vehicle, but it's expected to decline. And by the way, EVs now account for around about 10% of US new car sales. So, it's a minority, but still a significant chunk of the market.
So you've mentioned a couple of times this pilot program that involved the University of Delaware, Delmarva Power, and this V2G program. Can you talk a little bit about what Delmarva Power saw in this program and why it kind of helped them kind of see the value of V2G?
Well, Delmarva concluded that that V2G is in fact scalable. And they did that on the basis that the pilot program was conducted using real world conditions. So that means, that is, they used EVs, their own EVs, but they are commercially available. They used up-to-date charging equipment, and they noted that industry standards are changing in a way that would enable a broad-based deployment of this technology. So they concluded from on the basis of all of that yes, this is a scalable idea.
You mentioned some of the money that could be available to consumers who adopt this, or maybe companies or school districts that involve their fleets in this. Tell me a little bit more about that and how much they see this as an incentive for people to get involved in this.
Well, as we said, there's potentially thousands of dollars on the line for EV users and fleet operators, and this would help to erode the price differential between, you know, for potential buyers of an EV versus that of a conventional car. As we know, federal tax breaks for purchases of EVs were ended with the so-called Big Beautiful Bill in September of 2025. But nevertheless, as we said, there's a fairly significant section of the market which is already taken by these, and the advocates hope that more people will be drawn into this market by the prospects of actually making some money out of selling this power back to the grid.
Is there anything consumers would need to do to take advantage of this V2G technology, or is it more waiting for the cars that are already fitted for it to be available?
The conclusion of the study that this is a scalable technology is based on the idea that EVs will be made in future with the technology already fitted. It's not based on the assumption, if you like, of an individual retrofit of EVs by the owners. The idea of scalability is much more based on the expectation that manufacturers will do this. And speaking with Dr. Kempton a couple of days ago, he did say he expects at least one manufacturer to start producing EVs with the V2G technology during 2027. He declined to identify that manufacturer because he's got a non-disclosure agreement, but he seemed pretty confident on that.
You've talked a couple of times about the need for some policy changes at the state and federal level to make this technology more readily used and available. What are some of the things that are kind of still out there that need to be done to move this forward?
Well, part of the puzzle here is that the state needs to change part of its regulation. And there is a bill which is under discussion by something called the Energy Stakeholders Group. That's a group of power executives, environmentalists, public advocates, and so on. That group is led by Senator Stephanie Hansen. And so she's proposed a bill that would allow utilities to treat storage in a way that helps both the grid and customers. So her spokesman says that there are active discussions in that panel on that bill at the moment, and assuming that the panel approves the proposed language, then it will go to the legislature. Unclear whether that will be voted on during the current session, but that's the status.
What does a grid operator like PJM think about this? Do they see this as something that could be very, very helpful to the issues they're dealing with?
Well, what PJM says is that V2G is not yet used at scale, but it represents a significant storage resource that could help consumers lower their costs and even provide these cash payments that we've been talking about. I mean, we should say that PJM is urgently looking for solutions to boost power during the grid because of a lot of forecasts, including its own, that demand primarily from data centers is going to outstrip supply quite soon in the next few years, and so that expectation is already resulting in higher electricity costs.
John, based on all of this type of stuff that you've been reporting on, do you feel like this is a tipping point for V2G? Has it reached the point where it's ripe?
Well, there seem to be many more points in its favor than when it was first floated nearly 30 years ago. For one, it helps to address electric supply concerns, particularly from as a result of the advent of data centers. There's cash incentives. There's endorsement. The endorsement by the local local distributor, that is Delmarva Power, and the grid operator PJM. EV costs are coming down and regulation is changing. So all of those things are new conditions that would seem to be in the favor of the wide-scale adoption of this technology.
Thanks to contributor John Hurdle for his time this week. John's piece on vehicle-to-grid technology is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. Up next, Arts Playlist, where we preview the local performance of the first opera written in a U.S. tribal language. That's next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The Wilmington Concert Opera returns to the stage this weekend with the Delaware premiere of the first opera written in a U.S. tribal language. On this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny speaks to the Wilmington Concert Opera's artistic director, Kirsten Kunkel, herself a member of the Muscogee Nation, about the performance.
This is such a poignant story. Can you give me just a quick synopsis of the tale this opera tells?
Absolutely. So the title, Loxie Shali, roughly translates to Shell Shaker. And it is the story of a young girl named Loxie, which translates to turtle. And she has all of these interactions with the children her age where they make fun of her for being slow, like the turtle. And she goes to her mother and her grandmother and says, I don't like the way that they're treating me. And they say, well, it's actually an honor to be named after the turtle, but go and talk to the river and the river will guide you. So she has a conversation with her father and then she goes and talks to the river and the river sends her on a journey where she meets the actual turtle. And he introduces her to these animal teachers who teach her life lessons. And they have a wonderful time together and she's gone for a number of years and lives with this turtle. And at some point, he reaches the end of his life, and the grandmother, which is the role I play, comes as the spirit of the grandmother turtle, and she comes and she takes his spirit away. But before she leaves, she tells Loxie, the young girl, to take his shells back to her tribe. And she takes those shells back to the tribe and becomes a leader of her tribe. And that's the idea of where the shell shaking tradition begins. So this is a story that is created as part of this overall experience of this opera. And it's based in folklore and of the Chickasaw Nation. And a number of us who are involved in the production come from shell shaking traditions. So it's very exciting to have our heritage is represented on the operatic stage.
One thing that struck me about this opera is the universality of how it begins. I think all of us have had that universal experience in the first act of being teased, bullied, treated as different. And I love that this opera starts from that common ground.
Absolutely. I agree. It's one thing that I've noticed the more and more I work with my classical native singers and musicians, instrumentalists, is that we all seem to get along very well because we understand where we're all coming from, but that all of these ideas are things that apply to everyone at a human level. And because of that, it should appeal to pretty much anyone who comes to the show and they can see an element of themselves in it somewhere. And I think that's one of the things I really like about what's happening, not just with this piece, but with modern opera in general, is that I think it's trying to become more accessible and relatable in many ways across the board. And of course, as you know, we've discussed, that's part of Wilmington Concert Opera's mission, is always bringing that to the table as well.
Let's talk a little bit about the composer of this work and how you discovered this opera.
So Jared Bichacha Tate is the leading symphonic composer in the classical native world. And he and I have been colleagues and friends for quite a while. We met at the National Museum of the American Indian, Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. when I was finishing my doctorate. So it's been a number of years since then. And we were able to work together in 2021 in Bozeman, which is now Opera Montana, and did a program together, and we collaborated on one of my works and one of his works. And he's actually become a very good friend and colleague because he's inspired me to become a much more of a composer myself, but he's also written a number of works that I've premiered. So I was part of the original team that premiered this opera in Oklahoma City with Canterbury Voices. And in fact, everyone who has a principal role in our production was part of that original team that premiered the roles. So we have a number of people that are from Oklahoma, but we also have a number of people that are not involved in this production and a number of people that are local as well. So it's very exciting. But yeah, so I've been involved with Luxi Shelley since its onset and actually before it was ever written. I was part of a libretto read and then the libretto changed completely. But I was always kind of slated after my initial audition to be this role of the grandmother. And it's a role I take very seriously and I consider quite an honor because elders are always considered to be the most respected in any tribe. And the role of the grandmother in this is so important and pivotal in what happens with Luxi in her life and how she becomes a leader. So I take it very much as an honor that I was considered and given that role.
The story behind this opera comes from a Chickasaw legend, and I want to note that you've been called the leading Native American soprano working today. And I wonder, does performing this work feel different than presenting Mozart or Rossini?
To me, yes. To me. I think there are many levels on why that is the case, but partially it is because I have a friendship and a shared desire to make Native American representation on the operatic stage to be something that happens not just this one time or through this one opera, but to be happening frequently and to be that representation we need for the next generation. So I think because of that, in and of itself, yes, it's different. It's also a very different sing. The way Jared tends to compose is bombastic, big, full orchestras. It's almost Wagnerian. That being said, I need to have the same solid technique that I would sing with Strauss, Puccini, Mozart to be able to do it effectively.
You brought up a couple of points here that I sort of want to get a little bit deeper into. And the first is that, you know, I wonder from a musical perspective, does the music in this opera hew pretty closely to the European classical tradition? Does it diverge sonically?
Both. I would say both. Jared is very, very educated and established in classical Western music, but he definitely has his own style. And he pulls frequently from the music of the tribes, and not just the Chickasaw Nation, but other tribes as well. I think this particular iteration is going to be a little different because we are downsizing it considerably. It was originally about a 3-hour opera. Now it's going to be about 70 minutes. We have taken the 160 voice choir. It is down to 5 people who are also the animal teachers. And we are now using a chamber orchestra. All that being said, I think that will just mean that we have that same abundance of sound in a smaller space, because both of the places we've performed this previously have been places that are much bigger than the church we are going to be performing in. We're performing in Saints Andrew and Matthew in Wilmington, and it's considerably smaller than, you know, the the Civic Center in Oklahoma City, for example. So I think that his style is uniquely his own, but it is rooted in classical tradition, and that unique style makes it interesting while still being accessible based on what we know and are consider something that our ears are used to hearing.
You mentioned representation earlier, and this opera raises that ongoing discussion that we're having in the world of classical music and in the world of opera about representation. I think we can all acknowledge there's a lot more work to be done, but are you optimistic?
I never, ever considered that I would get to sing in a tribal language as an opera singer. I never considered that I would get to work with other native people in the classical music field. So there has already been so much more to my career than I ever anticipated in such a good way that I can only see it going up. I can only see more collaborations happening. I see them happening regularly. There's, you know, I was part of something called the Good Medicine Indigenous Music Festival in Houston this last year. That is such a profound idea that never would have happened in the classical music world when I was starting out, when I was doing my undergrad. And when I did my doctorate and I did my Alex Posey project and commissioned songs based on my ancestors' poetry, that was wildly new. And no one was doing that. And so I feel like I'm very much part of this movement. And we've even called it a bit of a renaissance because it is something that's so profoundly important. And it's now just starting to get traction in the bigger musical world of classical music. It's not to say that it hasn't existed. It just wasn't being done on that big of a level. And I think that there are important people in the past that have tried to do more and had a little bit of success, but they hadn't broken through in what the way that it's happening now. So yes, I think, you know, sometimes it's baby steps, but right now we've got momentum. And I think the more that people see this kind of thing happening, first of all, they'll realize that it wasn't happening because they may not have ever thought of it. But we also want it to involve our tribal communities so that they see that they can be part of this classical musical world that may have never been a consideration for them in the past. And so I think we're trying to bridge that gap. And I think that that is happening slowly but surely. And the more we do this, the more we interview and talk about it, but also the more we present, the more likelihood those opportunities will come. The fact that our little startup company, you know, that's been around 10 years now, is presenting this opera on any level, chamber music or otherwise, at the Opera America Conference speaks volumes. And I'm so excited to be part of that and be part of the team promoting it. So yes, I'm highly optimistic.
Thanks to Wilmington Concert Opera Artistic Director Kirsten Kunkel for joining our Martin Matheny on this edition of Arts Playlist. The Wilmington Concert Opera's performance of Lokshi Shali is next weekend. Tickets and showtimes are available at wilmingtonconcertopera.com. And we close out the green next with Enlighten Me, where we feature a Delawareans documentary on dealing with stress by staying connected. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. A recent documentary looks at how stress can affect our lives and how you don't have to heal alone. Friends and Neighbors is a film by Wilmington resident Benjamin Wagner, who shares how dealing with chronic stress and trauma can shape our lives. In the film, he shares his story, along with conversations with experts and neighbors as they show how you can heal and still connect with those around you. In this edition of Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Joe Irizarry speaks with Wagner about his film and life experiences.
Friends and Neighbors, your latest film. What is Friends and Neighbors about?
It's really about it begins with my experience addressing stress and trauma in my own life. and expands really rapidly into this, you know, epiphany, if you will, that the experience I was having, which often feels very lonesome and isolating, distress, was something that was happening all around us. I mean, I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress in 2021. So it's, you know, COVID. You know, people are reporting very high levels of anxiety and depression, right? Liquor stores are their business is booming. And I was that guy. I had been globetrotting as part of the Facebook Journalism Project. I had just moved to Delaware from New York City. And I didn't know it, but I was on the edge of burnout. So as a guy who's worked in media for 30 years, has been a journalist since he was 15, writing soccer stories for the Suburban and Wayne Times, I did what comes naturally and grabbed a camera and started documenting the experience, not just the experience I was having, but I went looking for the helpers. My first documentary is called Mr. Rogers and Me. Fred always used to say, when you see scary things in the news, look for the helpers and you know that there's hope. So I set out looking for the helpers around the state of Delaware in my neighborhood and amongst my friends and neighbors.
When did you say that, you know, this is the film that I need to make now?
Great question. My brother and I made Mr. Rogers and Me after meeting Fred, I mean, more than a decade ago. And we had a little nut of cash that we had set aside from the earnings of that film. Not that it was crazy amounts, but just a teensy little bit because we never paid ourselves. We did it. We gave some to the Fred Rogers Library in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, and the rest we put in this little account to save to do something else, something that mattered, something that was meaningful. And I think the moment was I was watching – I was actually having an anniversary podcast with some of the folks who had been in Mr. Rogers and Me, Tim Madigan, Amy Hollingsworth, my brother. And I was going back over Fred footage, and there's this great footage of him in the Senate in 1964 or so, and he's trying to get the $20 million to keep Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood on air. And he says, if we can only help people understand that feelings are mentionable and manageable, then we'll have done a terrific public service for mental health. And I had forgotten the for mental health part. We'd actually used that clip in the first movie without that bit because I wasn't hip to mental health in 2008, 9, and 10 when I was doing the first movie. I didn't – frankly, it just didn't seem like it applied to me. But when I saw that clip and I'm in the depths of despair myself, I'm feeling unsettled, unsteady, uncomfortable all the time, I thought, oh, this is it. Fred's the key. And together with the diagnosis, it just seemed to make a lot of sense that this was a way to help other people. So, you know, Fred used to say, what's – personal is also universal, right? The things that we think are exclusively our experience are often experiences shared by many, many people. So I set out to tell what was a me story because I knew the data supported that it's a we story.
How hard is it to put your life out there? It's not easy to discuss depression, stress, mental health, you know, trauma, PTSD. You know, you share a lot about your life from childhood to adulthood, and you know, how did that feel?
Well, I mean, if I'm being honest, it doesn't feel great. I will say, and this is I think the trick with feelings being mentionable and manageable, which is the more you hold on to them, the more you kind of stuff them down, the more shame, the more sadness, the more sort of physical discomfort I now know I was carrying. So, I mean, it feels a lot better than that. You know, if I'm being honest, it feels a little awkward pretty often. I just gave a speech an hour ago and told some of this stuff. I've been doing lots of interviews about it. But it is my hope. And it is my, you know, the data seems to support it, or let me say this differently. It is my hope, and I've also seen this happen at every screening, and it's happened since Mr. Rogers and Me, that when you're able to tell the truth about your own, you know, difficult moments, we all have them, right? We all have loss and grief, something weird with our parents or a sibling or at school or what have you. Like, I don't think there's a, you know, human that doesn't suffer or struggle. So I don't know. I moved through that discomfort pretty quickly because I know that it's of value to others. I've seen it. People come up to me after screenings and want to share, you know, something they've never told anybody. That's the cool thing. It's kind of viral in a positive way, right? Like it creates a sort of imperative for a small group of people to then share their things with each other. So, I mean, yeah, it's kind of uncomfortable. It gets easier. I would say, frankly, talking about like how much beer you drink is not really a conversation most of us have, but probably more of us need to, you know? And again, the data supports it. And I'll tell you, man, like once I learned about the research and the physiology behind a lot of this stuff, I'm Gen X. So a lot of it was a little eye-rolly for me once upon a time, you know, like, okay, hippie. But, you know, you get a little older, you get a little more comfortable in your skin. But moreover, I learned some of this research, like, you know, there's a direct correlation between adverse childhood experiences, things like divorce, having parents who are incarcerated, having parents who have mental health issues, growing up around violence, domestic abuse, right? These things have a direct correlation to things like the likelihood of drug addiction, the likelihood of being in an adverse experience later in your life, incarceration, all that stuff. So there's a straight line. This is a Folletti's research from the 90s and early aughts called the ACEs, Adverse Childhood Experiences Research. There's a straight line. And once you start to get into the physiology and you understand the brain science, for me, the sort of Gen Xer who is like, whatever, hippie, it gets grounded in something that's really usable and practical and like tangibly real. And that helped me. That, I find that to be very helpful. And it's less esoteric. It's you can put a finger on it. It makes better sense. You can measure it.
As part of the film, You interview your parents.
Yeah.
And that's not an easy thing. You know, just in everyday life, sometimes talking to your parents about the tough things, stuff that happened in the past can be tough. Here you are doing it as part of a film that you're sharing with the world.
So yeah, yeah.
How was that like? Did you have to do some real convincing to get them to talk so openly about uncomfortable topics, or was it just, hey, we know what this is about, and boom.
They knew what it was about because I had told them. I'm a surprise, surprise. I'm a pretty transparent person. I'll tell you this because you'll find this interesting. You're a journalist. There's a solid argument that says me being a journalist is a direct response to growing up in a household where I didn't know what was happening at any given moment. So what do I grow up to become? A person who asks questions for a living, right? A person who's trying to put a finger on just what's happening in the world, in my community, in a given moment. So I find that to be a pretty interesting sort of through line. And I think that to some degree, man, like I was always asking these questions. The difference is I think they expected or hoped I would just drop it. You know, so I would put a record out, as I mentioned in the movie, I had a record called Crash Site. And frankly, most of my records touch on some of this stuff. Because I'm a singer-songwriter, so what are you going to pull from? You know, yeah, you're going to pull from, like, I fell in love with this beautiful woman and I want to get married and have babies or whatever, like the romance. But the other side of that is you're going to pull on the hard stuff. I wrote in the early aughts, I was what used to be referred to as a blogger. I used to write every day as a means to try and build audience to come to my shows and then to come see my movies. And I would often write about tough stuff there. So I think they knew. And then – not so long ago during COVID, I started doing a podcast called Friends and Neighbors, in which this stuff came up. I interviewed my brother, and I remember my dad being like, could you just not have talked about the divorce? And I was like, well, and it's a, you know, for us, it's a big part of the story, you know? So I don't think it was a huge surprise to them. And no, I didn't have to do a lot of smooth talking. I said, here's what I'm trying to do. Here's why I'm doing it. I did say, and this is an unusual move for a journalist, but I said, if there's anything you're uncomfortable with, we can talk about it. You know, I'm not saying like it's ironclad. Normally as a journalist, if you say I'm off the record, you're off the record. Otherwise you're on the record. In this case, I said, listen, I don't want to hurt anybody. I want to help. And I think that they rallied behind that concept above all, truly. Both of them did it, I think, for slightly different reasons. I think they understood, as I do, that there's an opportunity to help people because these are shared experiences. Again, the specifics, maybe not so much, but broadly speaking, like families are full of dynamics, you know? And we didn't all inherit Mr. Rogers as our dad, you know what I mean? So this is an opportunity for all of us to try and help.
So where and when can people watch Friends and Neighbors?
Sure. Friends and Neighbors is available now for free at your PBS station. It's on their apps. And then as of May 15th, it will be also on Apple and Amazon. The only difference is the free one is 56 minutes and the rental one is 70 minutes. One is slightly more cinematic. I always advocate as a filmmaker, of course, for the cinematic. But either way, the information's in there, the journey's in there, and that's what's really important.
Thanks to Friends and Neighbors filmmaker Benjamin Wagner and our Joe Irizarry for enlightening us this week. There will be a screening of Friends and Neighbors at the Dover Public Library on May 12th at 5 p.m. with Benjamin Wagner and State Representative Alana Berry, who's in the film. And that's all we have time for on this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, contributor John Hurdle, Delaware Public Media's Bento Boutier, Joe Irizarry, and Martin Matheny, along with our producer, Jay Shaw. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.